So anyway, if that squirrel ends up figuring out how to untie that knot, it's really going to ruin our jasmine bush. Oh, hi, I didn't see you come in. Welcome back to We've Got Mail, the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
Hold on. Let me get my smoking jacket on. I don't smoke, but I do have the jacket. And my fez, how's that look? Is it all right?
It looks swank.
And my mustache wax. Is it holding?
You look gorgeous, sir.
And the musk, what do you think of the odor?
Well, you always have a nice musk.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. My name is Winnie Seibold. I am classy AF. For the purposes of this email, you may call me Rockmeister McCool.
That's right.
And sometimes we're fancy.
Not often.
But not often.
No, this is We've Got Mail. This is our letters podcast here at Critically Acclaimed. You write us a letter. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Or you can send us a snail mail at our P.O. box. Whitney, what is that?
Send us an actual physical letter. Put it in an envelope. Address it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and then we take those letters and we read as many of them as we can while responding to them the way we do, which is perhaps a little long-winded. We could give you one-word answers if you wanted, I suppose, but I don't think that's quite
the spirit of
the thing. So anyway, we try to get to them as quick as we can. We don't like to dilly-dally right at the front. So Whitney, kick us off. What's our first letter?
Our first letter comes from Yuri. Hello,
hi, Yuri.
Hello, Will and Wit. Why, that's us.
Hmm.
I've written before talking about movie titles and their translations in Brazil. The other day, I remembered another good one, and that is Toby Hooper's The Fun House. Have you seen The Fun House?
I have seen The Fun House. It's takes too long to get going, but once it does, it's great.
The end, like when the monsters start showing up, that's pretty fun.
Yeah.
Here in Brazil, the movie is called Pay to Enter, Pray to Leave.
Ooh, good one.
That would be a tagline here in the United States.
Yeah, it's a good one, though. I like it.
Still in the realm of differences, MacGyver's intro in Brazil was accompanied by Rush's Tom Sawyer instead of the original theme song.
I don't know.
Interesting.
Oh, Tom Sawyer. Okay.
Rush's song.
The song Tom Sawyer, from... I thought you said, like, there was, like... Was there a famous Russian version of Tom Sawyer that had,
Rush,
like, a score that I...
The Canadian band Rush
did
a song called Tom Sawyer. Okay.
That's cool. So, actually, that's pretty cool. Honestly, that's probably better. I know that's sacrilege to some MacGyver fans out there. But
I don't know why, similar brands have different ingredients overseas. Like, that goes to food products, but also movies.
Like, there are sometimes regulations, though. Like, there are regulations in terms of, like, what types of food additives you're allowed to have. Europe has more strict rules about that.
So here in the United States, we have food that is nothing but additives.
Kind of, yeah.
There's going to be less food in our food.
People often
say,
like, hey, why is the food so much better in Europe? Because it's food there. Because it's actual food.
It's not just preservative.
There's here in L.A., you can get a Coke almost anywhere, but if you're lucky, you can get a Mexican Coke, which is made with sugar.
Instead of corn sweeteners.
Yeah. It's so much better. It's so much better.
There's been all these taste tests, like people can't tell the difference. You kind of can.
No, you can. You really can.
If you get like an ice cold one, maybe it kind of covers it up a little bit.
There's also, are you eating something with it as well? Mm-hmm. Has it been a long time since you had one? I mean, there might be reasons why your palate isn't as sensitive to it. But if you have them back to back, you're like, yeah, that one's better.
There used to be a taco joint near where we live. It was called Taco Miendo. And
it
closed down. They gave you gigantic burritos.
Oh my God, their shrimp burrito was the best.
And they had sodas imported from Mexico, including Mexican Squirt. And Squirt was always my jam when I was a kid.
Way better. Better, yeah.
Squirt and Cactus Cooler were my preferred sodas.
God, I miss that place so much.
Now let's talk about the real subject of this email.
Understood.
We've already gone on a tangent. That's what we do.
Yeah.
I've rewatched A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese through American cinema and a three-part series. The first time I watched it, it was in the theater, so it was almost a four-hour movie.
Mm.
In the documentary, he talks about American movies that shaped him in the history of cinema from the silent era until his generation started making movies.
Yeah.
If a similar project were made today, who would you cast in his role? The rules are basically, they can't talk about movies made after they started their careers. They can't talk very briefly about a couple, since Martin Scorsese talked about three that were released after his first feature. They have to cover mostly American movies. And consider that Scorsese covered until the late 60s. He talks about a couple of movies done after this period very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
They would have to talk about movies made from the 70s onward, respecting the first rule. Who would be your first choice?
Okay.
Love your show. Sincerely, Yuri.
So let me get this straight. We're looking for someone who would host this documentary.
Yes.
And would speak about movies from approximately like the history of cinema to when they started making films, to give you that sense of history. Interesting. You know, my first thought was actually Spike Lee, because he's brilliant. He respects film history. Yeah. He understands film history. But he didn't start making movies all that much after Martin Scorsese did. It was only about 10 years.
So we need to add... Well, the stipulation in the letter said the 70s. So, you know...
Someone who made movies in the 70s?
Started making movies after Scorsese started making movies.
I'm just saying, like, the 80s isn't that much further after the 70s. I don't know if we're going to get that entirely different perspective, or that kind of fresh perspective we're looking for. Sure. But Spike Lee would kill it, and you know it. Yeah. He'd be amazing.
Well, we would need somebody who's, you know, well-versed and scholarly about feature films.
You do. And you want someone...
But not... there are certain filmmakers who, like... know a lot about the movies they like, but not necessarily about sort of the general fineries of cinema history.
Yeah.
Someone like your Edgar Wrights. Like, he could talk your ear off about something like The Driver, you know, the movies he's watched multiple times and has remade in his own films. But I don't think he could, like, speak to, like...
Well,
American silent cinema.
Well, he has good taste, and I have seen, like, his lists of, like, the best movies ever and stuff. I think he'd do okay. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. Rian Johnson could probably do a great job. I know he's been pretty eloquent about his influences, and a lot of his influences are things that you wouldn't expect to influence something like The Last Jedi or whatever, and, like, he has a really good sense of film history.
We can only do American filmmakers.
Can we?
Well, they...
Because Edgar Wright's British.
They said...
Well, it's got a history of American cinema. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So Rian Johnson's in the mix. Spike Lee would be
Edgar Wright's out anyway. So an American filmmaker, like a relatively, relatively young
American
filmmaker.
You know
what would have
been great, and sadly he's no longer with us, is John Singleton. I feel like John Singleton would have done a wonderful job.
Yeah, John Singleton would have would have been really, really great.
Yeah.
Gene Campion's Australian.
so they're out. Yeah. Jeez. This is kind of hard.
This is kind of hard,
because there aren't enough of the younger wave of filmmakers who feel truly scholarly about the cinema that they're in.
At least not yet. Like, they're still... Yeah. The people we're thinking of there are probably still working on, like, maybe their fourth movie or fourth or fifth movie. Maybe they do have deep abiding knowledge of cinema. We just haven't heard them speak to it yet.
That's also a distinct possibility. Mm-hmm. But you do want to get someone who... because their hosting has this imprimatur of quality. Mm-hmm. Scorsese hosting a documentary like this is going to hold a lot more clout than if, like, Robert Schwenke is. And, like, maybe Robert Schwenke is really brilliant when it comes to film history. I'm not a huge fan of his movies, but maybe...
Schwenke.
Okay, whatever. Yeah. My point is this. He's not someone who's going to put butts in the seats, and he's not going to be like, ooh, let's find out what he thinks. Like, that's going to be really interesting. Like, he's just... That's no disrespect to him. That's just... He doesn't have that clout.
Yeah.
You want someone with clout. So...
I think Spike Lee is perhaps a good one. You know, you're getting in an extra 20 years of film history.
Yeah.
The people I would think of, you know, somebody like Terrence Malick, he was making movies contemporaneously with Scorsese.
Yeah. Be very curious to see what he'd do, though. Just actually be that didactic. I can't even imagine.
I would love to see, you'd be surprised at how well-versed a lot of, like, the no wave grindhouse kind of filmmakers are, like the kind of deep cut stuff they would be interested. I bet Sam Raimi could speak very eloquently certain kinds of movies.
Yeah, I'm very, very sure he could, yeah.
I'd love to hear what, like, someone like Frank Henenlotter would have to say. But no one would say...
he might start making movies in the 70s. I just had this gasp. I was like, John Waters! Oh, that would have been awesome.
He was making short films like...
He was.
Mondo
can't
Trash
do it.
Is like 68. Yeah,
where are all of our favorites from that era? It's not that I haven't done a favorite.
Because
this...
we've been living with them for a while.
That's
These
true.
Are like filmmakers whose careers we've seen throughout our whole lives.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're thinking of the filmmakers that have been present with us a lot. We're not... Our minds aren't going to the filmmakers we were introduced to in the last decade.
More contemporaneous with Spike Lee. They got their start in the 80s. The Coen brothers.
Coen brothers? All right.
That could be exciting. Right. Journey Through American History with the Coen brothers? I think we'd all watch that.
David Gordon Green would probably have some really interesting things to say.
Yeah, I think so.
David Gordon Green didn't make his first movie until, I think, 2000.
Give or take,
film.
George Washington.
George Washington. So that would give you a few extra decades of history. And he's pretty young. He's only in his mid-40s, I think.
Yeah.
as, you know, sort of, quote, established filmmakers go. Yeah.
No, jeez.
Yeah, who else are, like, some important filmmakers that rose up, like, in the last couple of years? Charlie Kaufman, maybe? I'm not sure if he's considered, like, an important filmmaker. I just think he's an interesting one.
I think he's an important storyteller, whether you consider, like, his screenwriting efforts where he didn't direct it as the filmmaker. But I think he'd be an interesting voice. He's so distinct, though. I wonder how much of his work actually relates to the topic at hand. I'm thinking someone like Jordan Peele is very knowledgeable about film history. He's newer.
That's true.
As a filmmaker, but
he's only directed two feature. I guess his third one's coming out soon.
Yeah. I mean, he did a lot of TV and stuff, but yeah, that's not quite the same thing. No, damn it. Started in the 70s. David Lynch. Damn it.
Yeah. David Lynch started in the 70s.
Damn it. Damn it. I keep getting these gasp moments, and it's like, no.
Linklater started in, like, the late 80s.
Linklater would be good, though.
Linklater would be good, you think?
I think Linklater would be good.
I'm like, I'd love to hear what Linklater would say. Yeah. I'm just trying to wonder if he qualifies.
I think I think Spike Lee qualifies. Linklater qualifies. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the case.
She hasn't made too many movies, but I'd love to hear what Lynn Ramsey... But she's not American.
She's not American.
She's Scottish. No. Never mind. Lynn Ramsey is out.
Ava DuVernay is very well... very well read and very knows a lot about film history. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Hey, she's only made a couple features. She made Selma.
Well, she had that TV series 13th, as well that was very well established. That won some awards and stuff. I missed it, actually. I heard it was great.
I saw her film version of A Wrinkle in Time, and actually, I didn't like that movie.
I was looking forward to it because it looked really interesting. It just wasn't for me, but I respected that she did something very different. But that's neither here nor there. I just want to see you do a documentary. This is interesting. Hey, everybody. Let us know.
Who's like an important newer American filmmaker?
Who are the big American filmmakers who you feel are actually like guiding us, not just like to their films or into the future, but are actually helping you explore the past? Who's doing that right now? I'm actually very curious about that. The person who comes to mind definitely is Rian Johnson. I feel like Rian Johnson is trying to put an effort out there.
He's making like big blockbusters, but at the same time, like trying to point a younger audience toward older movies.
Indeed. Very curious to hear your thoughts. But let's move on. And thank you for the interesting question.
Right. Here is a letter from Toby.
Hi, Toby.
Hello, Toby. Hi there, Bibs and Rockmeister. My name is Tobias, or Toby for short. And I was pleasantly surprised to hear you call out my name on a previous episode of We've Got Mail. My friend Nikolai wrote to you about our global friend group that we formed while studying at USC, another member of this friend group, and about my adventure to the South Pole earlier this year. I remember that letter. I've been home for a little over a month and have a lot of podcasting to catch up on, including yours. I simply want to thank you for my birthday greeting on February 4th, and also give a slight correction to the mail from the mail that Nico sent, and correcting the two of you on a minor detail.
Uh-oh.
Nico informed you that we had an average temperature of 7 degrees Fahrenheit, which is actually we had negative 17.
Ooh.
And that's when there was no wind. By the time we got to the temperature, by the time we left, the temperature had dropped to an average of negative 32. This might have just been a typo, who can tell, but let's just say that this Canadian has never learned how to complain about cold weather for the rest of my life. And you two gents made a common mistake of confusing Antarctica with the South Pole itself. We did conflate the two.
No, we did.
I know the difference, but I did conflate
the two. It's a colloquialism, but yes, we did that.
The pole is in the center of the continent,
but
it's more of an independent state, which is why when Bib says, I hope you see penguins, you confused Antarctica, where they live, with the South Pole, where they do not.
Fair enough.
No, there are no penguins that far inland, I guess.
No, that tracks.
They're aquatic animals. They would live by the water.
That tracks. Yeah. I assumed you would have to travel through penguin country to get to the South Pole. You know, at least like, you know, take a little bus or something.
We can't stop here. This is penguin country. There's, in fact, low intelligent life form in the South Pole at all, because it's far too away from any water, mouse, or food sources.
Yep.
So when people say, you can see penguins on the South Pole because they live in Antarctica, it's like saying you can see sea lions in the Nevada desert because they live in North America.
Fair enough.
Okay, well.
Whoops!
I don't know. Those desert sea lions are pretty nasty characters.
Now that sounds like a sci-fi original movie I'd watch.
Desert sea lions!
You can just imagine, like, rah, like, they're swimming
long,
through the dunes, like Scrooge McDuck through gold coins.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
They're like the creatures from Tremors.
Yeah.
I don't blame you because, as I said, it's a common mistake to make, but yes, I did see both Emperor and Chinstrap penguins alongside orcas, yes, seals, and albatross during our two-day layover
at the
coast of Antarctica while we waited for a blizzard to subside. And yes, Bibbs, penguins are adorable until they steal the fish you've caught in your fishing net, and then they peck you for trying to take it back.
To be fair, that was the penguin's fish. It left it in the water for later.
You borrowed the penguin's fish. It was just taking it back.
Yeah. What do you live here? The penguin lives here. That's like going into someone else's house and making a sandwich and being mad when they eat half of it. Like, it's their sandwich. You just showed up. I'm kidding, of course. I'm sorry about your fish.
I do appreciate the fact that penguins have no land-bound predators.
Yeah.
So if you walk up to a penguin, it's not going to be afraid of you. You're clearly not a predator.
Yeah, there's no such thing.
Sea lions or seals will jump out of the water and eat a penguin.
Yeah, but they're in the water.
But yeah, so they stay away from the water. They're careful around the seals.
Yeah, I love penguins so much.
But like I said, thank you for the birthday greeting and the downloaded episodes of your podcast alongside other great film review podcasts such as Mark Cromody, Linoleum Knife, and others. It really made the trip more enjoyable, particularly during the 3 days when I was quarantined in my room without any lights because I got hit with photokeratitis, also known as snow blindness.
Wow.
Have you ever wondered what it feels like to get a sunburn on your eyeball? That's the answer. Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. I've heard about that, but I never know anyone who actually had it. That's incredible. Yeah.
It's one of those things you read about in elementary school.
Yeah, like there's your adventure novels or something. Or I think Inspector Gadget had that one.
Photokeratitis.
Yeah.
I really did have a wonderful trip, and I'm also glad to be back home with my girlfriend and see my family again. It was, however, sad that my laptop decided to crash the day before I left for the trip, and thereby lost a lot of your previous episodes that you made with Podcast One and no longer have in your inventory. Mm-hmm. But hey, that's what happens. And sorry on a final note, I agree with you, Morbius is a piece of shit.
Sorry you had to come back to Morbius. Yeah.
But this is the summer of Morbius. thank you again, and you may hear from me again someday. Sincerely, Toby, a.k.a. former Antarctican. Well, that's really cool.
That's super cool. Oh, my God. Sorry we conflated Antarctica with the South Pole. It's like it's a layperson thing. It's like when you go to the doctor and they talk about your lungs, but you say your throat. A lot of lay people, like, they don't realize that there's a difference, or they don't, like, it doesn't really matter in casual conversation, but a doctor knows that it matters to them.
I know that the South Pole is the pole. It's the actual, southernmost part of the planet, and...
Yeah. There's also geographic south and, like, magnetic South Pole. Aren't there, like, two poles, technically? There's one, like, actually at the bottom of the hemisphere, but there's also one that's magnetic, which is a little different.
I think so. I'd have to... That's something I knew in the fifth grade and don't know anymore. Yes, I know that is just sort of the southernmost point, whereas Antarctica is indeed an entire continent, and it covers a lot more than just the South Pole. It was not me making a mistake. It was me just sort of using common layperson, not even ignorance, just sort of inaccurate kind of language.
But regardless, thank you for correcting us, because we don't like to spread ignorance. I mean, it was an honest mistake, but education is more exciting than ignorance, I think. So thank you for correcting us. Thank you for making sure everyone listening knows the difference now. We apologize. Sorry about your snow blindness. That sounds like such a rough few days. My God. I'm glad you're better.
Glad you had some podcasts to sort of keep your ears entertained anyway.
Yeah, the Antarctic is such a fascinating place. There's an anime I watched for a while called A Place Further Than the Universe, which was an anime series about a group of teenage girls who were saving up to go on an expedition to Antarctica, like to be part of one, like as like interns. And it was actually very like peaceful and sweet, you know, just about like that kind of distance between you and the rest of the world. And then, of course, there's shit like Whiteout, which is like the first murder in Antarctica.
Oh, God.
Can Kate Beckinsale save the day?
I didn't see
the manga with the comic book's pretty good, actually. The movie sucked.
I know that they cat-cased Kate Beckinsale in the role. I think they'd written it for a male actor.
Well, in the comics, it was a woman.
Oh, okay. No, yeah. Maybe they didn't. I know that when they cast Kate Beckinsale, and I think she said this in an interview, that they actually wrote her a scene where she can like take a shower, just so they could get some like cheesecake and this like our Antarctic thriller. It's like, really? You're gonna sandwich that in there?
Yeah, that's how they do. How they do. It's embarrassing.
And Kate Beckinsale's like, you're okay with that? Yeah, I'm fine. I've been working out. Like she's just,
Well, kudos for Hurd for being a professional about it, but Kate Beckinsale is a brilliant actor and deserves better.
I was going to recommend Encounters at the End of the World. Did you ever see that one? It's the Herzog documentary.
I did a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a documentary about people who live at the South Pole and how there's actually a lot of people there and there's a lot of action and, you know, There is a scene where people are walking through a flock of penguins to get to, you know, the next leg of their journey.
I'll always remember the movie AVP, Alien versus Predator, where they say we have to go to the most isolated place in Antarctica. Mm. Yes, the freeze place furthest away from anything else. And then they get there and there are buildings. And I'm like, wait a minute.
Oh, it was like an old whaling village that had been...
Still!
Abandoned a long time
how,
ago.
It's like, how abandoned?
In that movie, they find this abandoned village. And they also find, like, a Pepsi bottle cap from, like, later than the age of the village. Which means, like, people had come and also plundered that village. Yeah. So people had gone back at least once.
It's not that isolated. Mm. It's, like, it's pretty isolated. Don't get me wrong. It's definitely more isolated than, like, you know, Riverside, California or something like that. It's isolated. It's more isolated than Barstow. But, like, it's not that isolated. There's stuff. There's stuff there. Also,
they go on a sleigh ride.
Also, there's a penguin. So, again, can't be that far in anyway. What I'm basically saying is, fuck you, Alien versus Predator.
Are you
what
saying
a terribly
that there,
written motion picture?
There might have been like some weird little some continuity problems,
minor
and
flaws,
inconsistencies with a movie like AVP, Alien versus Predator.
Mm-hmm.
The sequel, by the way, the full title of the sequel was AVPR:Aliens plural versus Predator - Requiem.
Yes,
that's a terrible movie.
Aliens vs. Predator Requiem joins Slenderman as one of the films that is just legitimately hardest to watch. I don't mean in terms of like, it's so painful, it's so bad. I mean, it's dark.
Like, they shot it so badly that you can't make out what's going on the screen.
It's like, we'll make it like super spooky. Like, no, you have to see something. Hmm. Otherwise, we're just sort of sitting here in darkness and we're watching a shitty radio play, because a radio play would tell you what was going on right now. So this isn't helping me at all.
As the young woman crept through the woods, her vision went black.
Yeah, the radio play. Like, Rayleigh Perspective is like, ah! Over there! Ah! Ah! And stuff!
I remember in Morbius, to go back to that crappy movie.
Please.
During the... there's this big climax. It starts, like, at the top of buildings, and it ends up in the subway. So, you know, they're kind of falling down.
They fall off a building. They're vampires. They're fun.
And, there were like two or three like 1 second shots in that final action piece where the vampires are like picking each other up and throwing each other through walls and stuff, and they're breaking through all this stuff, and there's all this noise and mayhem. There were a few single shots where it turned abstract.
I couldn't know what the hell was going on.
There was no, it was just like this.
Just swirling
big,
stuff.
Yeah, swirling bits of like wood and debris were just sort of flying through the air, and then they would edit on either side of that. So it was just like this one shot where they just filled the screen with nothing but like visual noise.
Even when they tried to like clean it up, like there's this bit in the middle where like the cops are shooting at Morbius, and he's like, no, don't shoot at me, I'll run. And he runs.
And he's not bulletproof, by the way.
No, I mean, I guess he'd survive it, but like
he's super fast though. So
he probably survived it, but it would suck. The bullets, you know? There's a bit where he, like, is, like, jumping up, like, some flights of, like, buildings or whatever like that. And it's all super fast, and you can't tell what the hell's going on. And then it slows down, like, for, like a kind of, like, that Zack Snyder speed ramp,
slow for a few moments and then fast again.
And then it goes fast again. And theoretically, that's there to show you what's going on. Still had no idea. I just thought they did it for fun. It wasn't until I saw the trailer again, by just chance, happened to be on Twitter, and I forgot not to click on it. Like, well, you know, like when they start playing, and it's like, okay, I'll stick with it. But I showed that shot in there, and I realized, that was like bullet time. You're supposed to be able to see bullets going past him. The fucking thing is so frenetic, even in slow-mo, I couldn't tell what was going on. Anyway, Antarctica. Moving on. Thank you for emailing us. I'm glad to get some more chapters of that story.
You know, a vampire can pick up and drink a penguin like it's a bottle of Gatorade.
Oh, no.
The big ones are like super gulps.
No.
I'm sorry.
No.
But vampire penguins.
Mr. Popper's Penguins, that's my favorite book growing up.
Mr. Popper's Vampire Penguins now.
Okay, that is a better book, I'll grant you. Moving on.
Okay. Here's a letter from Paul. Dear Bibbs and Whitney, after inhaling every episode of all our yesterdays in the space of a few weeks, oh my goodness, are
that's
you okay?
A lot. Yeah,
yeah. I just wanted to drop a line and say thanks for your enormously entertaining insight on Star Trek.
Ooh.
As a loyal listener of Roddenberry.com's Mission Log podcast, currently starting Voyager, following a 3.5 years on Deep Space Nine, I was skeptical about how much I needed a second chronological Trek recap podcast. Any doubts were swept away with the first episode. Duh. my non-Vulcan ears keep pricking up each time you mention the unmade Trek spinoff set on a medical ship. I keep expecting it to dovetail into talk about UPN's Mercy Point, which never comes, so please allow me to kick one off.
Please do.
Set in a hospital on a space station, the closest we've gotten to that unmade Trek series. It was even teased on UPN with a promo that asked the viewer to think of it as Deep Space 911. John Delancey even appears in the unaired presentation pilot. Unfortunately, instead of airing it with Voyager, UPN ran it after Moesha and Clueless, and Mercy Point was axed after only 3 weeks. Oh, well, we can do that on Cancel Too Soon, for
oh,
sure.
Oh, yeah. It might be on Crackle.
Mercy Point is on Crackle?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying is a maybe. I'm checking it out. Hang on.
It's a shame as the show was intelligent and thoughtful and was gradually developing a rich universe. Surprisingly, for a swiftly canceled series, it had a genuine sense of closure at the end. It's currently it's currently on Crackle.
Yeah, it's got
and
Crackle.
Plex. And that Plex. Presentation pilot is on YouTube.
Okay.
And it is well worth your time. Keep on trekking, Paul.
That is so up our alley, and it's weird we haven't done that yet. There's a sci-fi medical series from the 90s, and we just never got around to it. Yeah, are we stupid?
Like, 90s sci-fi is kind of our jam. Like, whenever we come across one, even if it's like Briscoe County Jr. and Legends, which are kind of the same show.
Both good.
Both good. I like both shows. Even when they do like The Flash or RoboCop, it's like those came out at the right time. That's the kind of showmaking we like. We haven't gotten to Mantis.
No, we need to.
We'll get to Mantis at some point.
We'll get to Mantis. Yeah. Oh, we'll get to Mantis.
Oh, we'll get to Mantis.
But moving on.
Here's a letter from Mina. Hello, Mina.
Hi, Mina.
Greetings, fellow alumni of good old Pimento U. P-U. P-U. We're all for you. Yeah, boom. Your recent Iron List about the best Looney Tunes was ever a delight. It left me wondering, what are a few of your favorite non-Looney Tunes cartoons?
Ah.
Best, Mina. P.S. What are the odds you'll do a future Iron List about the best MGM cartoons ever?
Probably slim. I'm not nearly as much of an expert on those. All I know is that the early Droopy cartoons are some of the funniest things anyone's ever done.
Yeah.
There's one in particular I want to make sure I give a shout out to.
I'm very fond of a Droopy short called Wild and Wolfy, where it's a Western spoof. It's a Tex Avery, so it's like just gag a minute sort of thing, and it's that. The Tex Avery Wolf character that was sort of popularized once again when the movie The Mask came out in the 90s. They started rerunning a lot of those cartoons on Cartoon Network after that. And that sort of like whistling, the wolf whistle at the pretty girl who was giving a performance or bang the table the chair on the table. That wolf character is now sort of like the villain in a Western, and Droopy is the hero, and it's just a bunch of really like nonstop frenetic gags.
Yeah, the wolf was frequently the antagonist of a lot of Droopy cartoons, and the idea was usually wasn't even that evil. He was just trying to get Droopy out of the way, but Droopy just won't stop. Yeah. It's like every episode, basically every Droopy cartoon with the wolf is like the tortoise and the hare, but instead of a race, they're trying to be matadors, which brings me to my favorite, which is actually called Senior Droopy. Which is where they're competing matadors, and it ends with Droopy getting a date with playing herself Lena Romay.
Nice.
Which is just an oh my god, some of the jokes in that one. There's just this great joke where the wolf is hiding from the bull, and he's hiding behind a wall, and he looks behind the wall, he looks to the left, and you can see like 20 miles in that direction, and there's nothing. And he looks to the right, and you can see like 20 miles in that direction, and there's nothing. And he just happily takes one step out, and the bull goes, just runs right over.
That's a gag in Wild and Wolfie, too.
Yeah, that's a good one.
He's crossing a road on a horse, and he steps into the road, and a truck hits him.
Gotta do it. It's so fucking funny.
Wild and Wolfie ends with... the wolf has kidnapped the pretty cowgirl and is holding her hostage like an old like Dudley Do-Right melodrama, and he ties her to a chair and for some reason throws a sheet over her. It's like you can't see anything, you just put a sheet over rather than blindfolding her. And he goes out and he fights Droopy and then defeats Droopy, locks him outside, turns around, whips the sheet off and begins kissing the girl, but it's Droopy underneath the sheet.
Right.
He's teleported inside. And the kiss is really hilarious because he kisses and doesn't disengage. Just like big eyes, still kissing, then really angry eyes, but still kissing, and then breaks off. It's like, wait a minute, not, who are you? You've been bugging me through this whole picture. And Droopy just says, he says his only line, haven't you heard I'm the hero? Hits him with a mallet, and that's the end of the cartoon.
By the way, hold on a second, just to make sure I get this right, too. I think it's just called Disco Droopy.
Disco Droopy?
Okay, hang on. No. Disco Droopy, which was a part of the Tom and Jerry comedy show, was a later edition. Mm-hmm. Like I would say it came out like 70s or 80s. Disco Droopy may be the worst cartoon I've ever seen. Not because it's inept. It is. Not because it's offensive. It's not.
It's just offensively awful. You
it's
showed
just
me this one once.
Not yeah. funny. Like, there's just nothing about it. There's the music is like nails on chalkboard annoying. The animation is repetitive and pointless. The plot is stupid. It takes for, it's like 5 minutes long and it's 8 days. It's so fucking bad. It is such a demerit on the history of Droopy, that you can only be mad at it. Moving on from Droopy, Tom and Jerry cartoons, I find, some of them have aged poorly. Some of them are offensive, but most of them are just like, they're so violent. It's just like, that's not really considered that funny anymore.
I've never been a big Tom and Jerry fan. Yeah. For the same reason, I'm not a big Three Stooges fan. There's just too much anger in their hatred for each other. Tom genuinely hates Jerry.
Yeah.
It's not,
Jerry
like a,
is mean to Tom. Like, Jerry knows. It's like cruel. It's like if Bugs Bunny hated Elmer Fudd. He didn't just do it because Elmer Fudd was trying to kill him. Like, he was just like, no, today I will destroy Elmer Fudd.
It's way different from, like, the Chuck Jones Roadrunner Coyote cartoons.
Yeah.
Because the Roadrunner is blissfully able to evade whatever that coyote has planned. The Roadrunner is in no risk of being destroyed, and the coyote comes about destruction through his own hand.
Yeah, the coyote, 99 times out of 100, the Roadrunner does almost nothing.
Yeah.
It might go meep meep and startle him, and like that's the most it will do. The Roadrunner almost has no agency. The Roadrunner is just going about doing, the Roadrunner just likes to run, man.
The Roadrunner is sort of like a nature god.
Yeah.
And the coyote is man,
trying
to control nature.
You're not wrong.
There's a theological part of that.
However, I will go to bat for one in particular. I'm sure there are more that have aged well, but I think Cat Concerto is great.
That's a Tom and Jerry?
The Tom and Jerry one. So they won an Oscar for it, I think, but it was Tom is, basically he's playing concerto. He's at a grand piano in front of a big audience, and it's... whatever that number is.
It's Hungarian Rhapsody number 5.
I think that's it. But the problem is that Jerry was sleeping in the piano. So Tom isn't trying to hurt Jerry, but he is disrupting Jerry. And Jerry is basically trying to protect his house. And Tom starts trying to attack Jerry with all of, like, the hammers inside the piano. And it's just very, very clever and wonderfully well conceived. And, yeah, that one works better than I think most of them do.
Tex Avery did a lot of really wonderful cartoons for MGM after he left Warner Brothers because of basic animosity between some of the people he was working with. I'm very fond of Red Hot Riding Hood, which you didn't get to see on TV a lot just because it's a little too sexy for kids.
Salacious.
I mean, those cartoons are all pretty salacious. It's like Swing Shift Cinderella and other sexy fairy tales besides. I'm fond of a cartoon he did called The Cuckoo Clock, which is this weird sort of like cat versus cuckoo clock living in, like a cuckoo living in a cuckoo clock, but via Edgar Allan Poe, like he's just like reciting it, like that cuckoo is driving me crazy.
That's cool.
And there's, cuckoo paints like a bird on its thumb and the cat ends up just like shooting off his own thumb. There's a lot of really funny just physical humor in that one.
There's a cartoon I only just saw and
he did The Magical Maestro.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, that one's tough because it has like blackface and
yeah,
like
a lot of these
stereotype
are
stereotype
gags
in it.
A lot of these are kind of problematic, but
that's the one that has it's a dog has discovered that his conductor's wand is a magic wand, and so he can change the nature of the person singing.
Yeah,
there's another dog singing on stage and keeps like changing his costumes with the magical wand. There's a gag in that which is sublime because after a while, the cartoon's about halfway over and the character's singing on stage and the other character's sort of like changing the outfits. And we notice in the bottom frame, there's a hair in the gate, which this isn't something you really see in movies anymore because it's all digital projectors. Yeah. But at the time when physical film was passing through the projector, dirt would get in there.
Yeah, it sometimes happens.
It's a dusty room. It wasn't completely sterile. So, occasionally there'd be like blobs on the screen and you have to get like a little blower, kind of blow it out. Or if there's a hair, you just have to wait till the film's over and you can take it out of the gate.
Pluck it,
They animated a hair into the gate. And it looks real. It's kind of like jerking around the way a hair would. And then the character leans down and plucks it out themselves.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
That's from Magical Maestro.
There's I never watched when I was a kid. It was never on. But I never watched Betty Boop.
Oh, you
did? It just wasn't on TV. Somehow I missed it. I saw a whole bunch of other stuff, like Jekyll, but I never saw Betty Boop for some reason.
A lot of the old... Well, Betty Boop was from the 1930s, and a lot of those older cartoons are in black and white. And because of the caprices of the people who were showing us these cartoons on Saturday morning in like these blocks, they'd buy them up from the studios, they only wanted the color cartoons. They wouldn't show the black and white ones.
Yeah.
Unless it was like... Steamboat Willie was kind of the only one, and that's because it was Mickey Mouse. But you didn't get a lot of Betty Boop cartoons, A, because they were in black and white, B, they're fucking weird. Those things are like acid trip nightmares. If you can watch the one with Betty Boop, Coco the Clown, singing Minnie the Moocher, and it's, that's kind of a little bit of a spooky melody, the Cab Calloway song.
Yeah.
It's like all these ghosts and weird monster images.
I was going to recommend this, because I finally... my partner, Michelle, they recommended, I think we watched the Betty Boop Snow White, which has this incredibly animated Cab Calloway number. Mm. I think it does Minnie the Moocher, but, it's like something Infirmary Blues or something like that. Mm. What? Hold on. What? Yes. That's the one. Okay. Thank you. Michelle was listening. absolutely stunning, haunting, eerie animation. So damn cool. You have to see it. It's on YouTube very easily. I had no idea how fascinating the early Betty Boop cartoons were. So I definitely want to give
those
that
are great. Those are Max Fleischer cartoons.
Yeah. Speaking of Fleischer, people don't talk about Popeye enough either.
Early Popeye from the 30s is those are masterworks. Yeah. When you get into the color Popeye stuff, I think it's a lot less interesting.
Well, I will give a shout out for there's one really great Popeye color cartoon, which was Popeye meets Sinbad the Sailor,
which is like the movie. It's like it's longer.
It's pretty long. I think it's like 16 minutes. But what's cool about it? One of the things that's really cool about it is. They did the traditional cel animation, but a lot of the sets are practical. They built like what you would have like for stop motion animation sets, and then like there's like little miniatures like caves and stuff like that, and they animated the in front of it.
Into that,
they give it a little bit more texture. Like, and it's weird that almost no one ever did that. It's just a cool looking thing, though. It's a neat cartoon. You should totally check it out.
It is really frustrating that because of the machine that makes animated films these days, a lot of them are CGI.
Yeah.
It's the bulk of animated films these days.
It's more efficient, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's why I react to something like Apollo 10 and a half. It's like, oh, they're actually doing something kind of interesting with the animated form, even though I've seen that look before, but it's not common.
I've seen a lot of like CG animated shows, which are like, I can tell they're good, but there's something about the animation style that I could just like, I would be so much more invested in this if this was 2D animated.
Like the
CG animated Green Lantern cartoon is actually really good.
Is that a new one? Or
relatively, like came out like 8 years ago, something like that. Right. But it came out around the time the movie did. It was not going to be related to it. It was just sort of concurrent.
Yeah.
Like when Batman the Animated Series came out around the same time as Tim Burton's Batman. Not the same continuity, but close enough.
Yeah. Well, the Animated Series was modeled after Tim Burton's
Batman. Yeah, it was modeled after it, but it wasn't the same. Like, that was a different Joker. That was a different Batman, that kind of thing. But it was clearly supposed to cash in. The movie was so unsuccessful that the show only got one season. We will do it one day and cancel too soon. The writing on that show is really cool.
Right.
It's really, really well written. It's as good as any Green Lantern series could probably be in like a televised or film medium. But the animation's always just holding it back a little for me. It just never always feels a little clunky, you know? So I don't know. What are you gonna do? Anyway, we should move on. So hopefully those are some suggestions.
Yeah. Go back to the Max Fleischer stuff. If you haven't seen the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons, those are excellent.
Some of them are super racist.
These are movies from the 1930s. Yeah. They're made by white filmmakers that had just very casually racist attitudes. You're gonna run into some racist imagery.
Most of the Superman cartoons are fine, but there's like two that are like super duper racist.
Yeah.
You'll figure it out quick which ones they are. One of them is in the title. I'm not even gonna say it out loud.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Yeah.
And we talked about that when Bugs Bunny is sort of like going up against these like Japanese caricatures because it was the war and they tried to make them look as terrible as possible.
Yeah, so fucking
really, really racist cartoons. You get to hear like Mel Blanc using racial slurs. It's the weirdest thing.
Disappointing.
Yeah, if you're used to What's Up, Doc, watch some of these other cartoons. Yeah, with racist titles that I'm not even going to say.
We're not going to say.
So, some of those early 30 ones, though, are just wonderful nightmares of complete swirling evil. And even though I'm not a big, big fan of Walter Lantz, because we haven't mentioned Walter Lantz yet.
No, we haven't.
There's always, like, one or two good gags in Walter Lantz cartoons. Walter Lantz did Woody Woodpecker and Chilly Willy.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan, but he's okay.
Walter Lantz, compared to a lot of his contemporaries, visually blank, just like nothing going on in a Walter Lantz cartoon. There's the shots are all very tight-knit. The characters are always about the same size. There's not a lot of visual dynamism. There's no like overhead shots. It's always just these sort of three panel newspaper strips kind of aesthetic to Chilly Willy cartoons. Some funny gags can be fit in there. You try hard enough, you're gonna find some funny gags. But yeah, Walter Lantz, I watched them as a kid just because I would watch anything that was animated. But wasn't ever a big, the biggest Woody Woodpecker or Chilly Willy fan.
Yeah. While we're on that subject, he did Oswald the Rabbit, or at least some of them. You got to give a shout out to a lot of, everyone gives a shout out to like Disney for being such a pioneer in animation. You should at least look into the filmography of Ub Iwerks, who worked
for Disney.
Worked with Disney. He probably did a lot of the stuff Disney gets a lot of credit for. Then he went off on his own to try to make his own career as an animator. Never quite worked out. He ended up going back to Disney for a while. It was like a whole thing. Amazing animation. Mm-hmm. Definitely worth checking out. I can't think of like a specific cartoon off the top of my head. He did one was like a Flip Frog.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Flippy the Frog?
I don't know about Flippy the Frog.
He worked on Skeleton Dance, which is like used all the time. Everyone loves that one. Flip the Frog.
Okay,
that was his attempt to do like his own like Mickey Mouse.
Yes.
And they're okay, but Mickey just had a stronger, I don't know, energy to it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You've seen Skeleton Dance. That one's hauled out.
Super famous.
It's in the public domain. They haul it out and throw it on any sort of late night Halloween program for kids.
Yeah.
Ub Iwerks.
He wasn't very funny, but he was a brilliant animator.
And if you want to go back really far, check out the works of Winsor McKay. But that's like going back to like the source of
Winsor McKay
animation.
Had this brilliant. Winsor McKay did what is considered like the first like proper like American cartoon, I think, although it's not really. It was Gertie the Dinosaur, and it was really really cool. And what he would do is
it was a stage performance.
It was a stage performance because it's not just a cartoon. You watch the cartoon and it's just this dinosaur walking through the camera, like, eating some stuff, getting in small
fights. It's fun animation.
It's neat animation, but the full show would be Winsor McKay walking out on stage saying, and I'm hazily remembering all
and
of this.
I've seen a film of it. Yeah. I don't think it was Winsor McKay, but it was somebody who had Winsor McKay's script reenacted.
Yeah, you can do the script, but basically just someone went up on stage next to the screen and says,
"This is Gertie the Dinosaur." We've
discovered dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are still alive. Meet Gertie. And then he would talk to Gertie, and he would tell Gertie stuff, and Gertie would laugh or interact. And then at one point, he walks behind the screen and into the cartoon, and then Gertie like picks him up and throws him like in the background. Yeah. It's great. It's like really clever. Like we jumped like Winsor McKay like jumped over the step where we take animation like super seriously and went right into meta humor like right away first thing. Like it's really incredible.
I love watching some of those old cartoons from like from the mid-30s because they're already animating animators.
Yeah,
like they're making cartoons within those cartoons. It's a little bizarre.
It's really interesting. Anyway, we should move on, but thank you for the opportunity to give a few other recommendations.
All right, here is a letter from Sergeant Siege. It is Screaming Eagles.
Oh god,
I think you know where this is from.
Okay.
Good evening, Viz and Whitney. I've seen a game making the rounds around social media. that asks, pick a movie, keep one actor, the rest are Muppets.
We've played this game in our own version before.
And I thought this would be a fun conversation fodder for we've got mail, so I'll start. Phone booth. Keep Kiefer Sutherland as the sniper. Everyone else are Muppets. Colin Farrell has been replaced by Gonzo.
Nice.
Thanks for the hours of fine podcasting you do each and every week. Sincerely, Sergeant Zeech and the Screaming Eagles.
Thank you for that. Mm. I have been suggesting a few films along those lines for a long time because when I was around 8 or 9, whenever, give or take, that's when The Muppet Christmas Carol came out. And between A Muppet Christmas Carol and Muppet Treasure Island, and to a lesser extent, Muppet Wizard of Oz, but no one cares, the Muppets for like my generation for about 10 years were people who adapted classic lit. And so the idea of using the Muppets to adapt a famous work is fair game. And not only can it be funny, but it can actually be very touching. You know, Muppet Christmas Carol is a genuinely good Christmas Carol. That one works. What is it? It's Michael Caine and Muppets. Boom, done.
Yeah, Muppet Treasure Island isn't as faithful to the source material.
No.
But, you know, it has all the characters, it has the elements. Fine with that. Ben Gunn is now Miss Piggy. It's okay, fine.
Treasure Island. I love Treasure Island. I grew up reading Treasure Island. Treasure Island, there's not as much to it as there is to A Christmas Carol. It's a pulpy adventure novel with like a really strong central relationship between Long John Silver and
Jim Hawkins.
And Jim Hawkins, yeah. Like, that's a great central relationship. The plot's really, really cool. Like, it all works. It's a great adventure. But there's not a lot of depth, really.
They were wise in Muppet Treasure Island to have Jim Hawkins and Long John Silver be the human actors.
Those are the ones with whom they are the ones who form a connection.
And Kermit was Captain Smollett. They didn't make Kermit into Jim Hawkins.
I think it would have been a mistake to do so. So, I think they did a good job. So that one you justified having to. But my point is this. There's a few films that I think have been aching to be made in this vein. One of which I've said a million times before. Muppet Dracula.
Muppet Dracula.
With Tom Hardy as Dracula. Tell me you can't see it.
Oscar Isaac for me. But I think.
They'd both be good. I still think. Tom Hardy would bring a weird sexual energy to it.
I suppose so.
So when he's like trying to seduce Miss Piggy, you know he's like. Because Oscar Isaac would seduce Miss Piggy, but he'd do it in a sort of a Gene Kelly kind of lithe, kind of romantic kind of way. Tom Hardy would be, like, all over her. Like, he would be like, he's the guy who, like, it was his idea to jump in the lobster tank in Venom. He's gonna, like, put Miss Piggy in his mouth and, like, run around the stage with her. With her, like, her neck in his mouth. Like, and I want to see that. That would be amazing.
The no-brainer for me is, why have they not done A Midsummer Night's Dream? Because you have the, because there's the three stories. There's the royals, there's the lovers, and there's the fairies. And
Who isn't the Muppet, though?
Well, the royals, clearly. Theseus and Hippolyta are human actors.
What about Oberon and Titania?
I guess... The lovers are humans, the fairies are Muppets. That's what you do. Oberon and Titania are Muppets as well.
Okay. It's a little complicated, but okay.
Helena, Hermia, Lysander, and Demetrius are all the human actors.
Yeah. What about, so if that's the case, then who's, bottom, is it bottom who gets turned into an ass?
Oh, and the players.
Okay, well that's a lot of people then.
Well, you got a lot of Muppets, don't you?
I guess.
The players are also Muppets.
Well, the other one I think, and this isn't a literary...
How about the players are all Muppets except for Bottom, and Bottom gets turned into a Muppet.
Now you're talking. Now you're talking. I like that. I've also suggested, in terms of going back to movies, that we were talking about lit. Muppet Star Wars, only Luke Skywalker. You get well, Tom Holland to play Luke Skywalker.
They kind of did that with Pigs in Space anyway.
Now you do it feature length. Okay, it's already canon. Like, so you do is, only Tom Holland is human. No one else. Everyone else is a Muppet. It works perfectly.
And Tom Holland is your casting for Luke Skywalker.
I think so. Because you want someone, you want like a star who's like kind of a get, like you're like, ooh, okay, I can see that. Mm. And it's okay because he's not actually replacing Luke Skywalker. He's just doing Luke Skywalker this. Yeah. And then like what we would do is basically, like, the whole trilogy in, like, one movie. Like, one long movie, like, 2.5 hours.
Just do the first Star Wars.
Well, you can do just Star Wars. My point is this. And then when you get to... when you finish the trilogy, if you want to do the prequels, then only Anakin is human.
There you go. That's
and good. Then when he puts on, but when he puts on like the Darth Vader helmet, that's when he becomes like, I don't know, Sweetums or something. I don't know. Like Darth Vader would be, I don't think who Darth Vader would be. Like who is the Darth Vader Muppet?
Well,
Uncle Deadly's got to be the Emperor.
I was going to say, I can't be Uncle Deadly. He's clearly the Emperor.
Clearly the Emperor.
Like Gonzo would look good in the in the mask, and I think they did do Gonzo as Darth Vader on Pigs in Space.
They had, but I think I think Gonzo and Rizzo or Pepe or one of those two, they have to be C-3PO and R2-D2.
Yeah, you're right.
There are windows into this story. They have to be that. So I would say for like Darth Vader, Sam the Eagle. Can you imagine just Sam the Eagle all like decked out in like sleek, shiny black cape? Right.
I find your lack of faith disturbing. I'm going to leave the room now.
See? Yeah, you're already laughing. It's great.
I can't do a Sam the Eagle voice.
No, it's not bad. It's not bad. All right, so we got one though. Let's come up with like at least two more.
All right. Let's see. Like, I like the idea of classic lit. That's just something. Because I think they did three of those three classic books. In Muppet fashion, and two of them were really good. The third one wasn't so good.
Well, I think
Muppet Wizard of Oz wasn't so great.
And the thing is that all of those had classic movie adaptations as well. It's just got to be something iconic, so that the audience is already kind of familiar with the story, and it doesn't really matter if they're seeing it again through the Muppets. It's not like this is your first introduction to blank.
I would love to see something like Muppet Godfather. Now. I'm totally serious about this, and of course, Don Corleone is the only human actor,
I'd say Michael.
You think Michael?
It's funnier if it's Michael.
Michael and
Duncan. No, because Michael can't be Kermit. Kermit can't be corrupted like that. So yeah, I don't know who Kermit would be then.
Sonny.
No, we can't have Kermit like beating up a guy in the street. Kermit. Okay, here's Kermit. Kermit is the consigliere. Kermit is Robert Duvall.
There you go. And okay. You'd have to. Of course, you'd have to. It couldn't be like Muppets gunning each other down.
Wow.
It would have to be like Bugsy Malone, where they replace it with pies or something.
Yeah, they shoot Nerf guns.
But that kind of a story that you could do a Muppet version of The Godfather.
That'd be very funny. I'm not gonna lie. That's really good, Whitney.
I know murder is a big part of that movie. Yeah. And you could do. They had murders in Muppet Treasure Island as well.
Oh yeah, they even say like, wait, can we have a dead body? This is a Muppet movie. What are we doing?
Yeah, Rizzo says he died. This is supposed to be a kids movie. Yeah.
Yeah, ooh, that's pretty good actually. you do good Muppet. You do good Muppet. I'm trying to think. There's got to be like. Oh my god. It's too soon since they've already done a version of it, but it would be great. Muppet on the Orient Express.
Would Poirot be the human?
Poirot is the human.
Okay.
No, Poirot has got to be Gonzo and Rizzo.
Gonzo and Rizzo.
Or Gonzo and Pepe. I know they're trying to make that thing happen. I'm fine with it. I don't know who's the human. The human's the victim.
Oh, there you go.
The human is the victim. The human is... Okay, there's two humans. There's the victim, and then there's...
And there's the killer.
not the killer. There's that one guy who, like, follows Poirot around. He's kind of... What?
Book.
Yeah, he's the human.
B-O-U-C. Book.
And he's the human. And he's just he's just a respectable get of it, like a Martin Freeman type or something.
Yeah, or the same actor who played Book in Brana's versions.
I would distance myself from it, but sure.
Or get Brana to play Book.
Oh my god!
You know, Brana would kill it next to some Muppets.
That would be Kenneth Branagh's Muppet Hamlet.
See, Muppet Shakespeare would be really great.
Muppet Shakespeare's funny, dude. Yeah. All right, we got to move on. We'll do one more letter and then we'll move on. But this is always a treat. Right. I keep waiting for a new good Muppet project. I don't know when it's coming, but hopefully someday.
I mean, I did like when they tried to sort of revitalize the Muppets in like, it was 2011 when they did that. But Jason Segel did the movie.
It was just called
The Muppets, and that's a good movie.
That's a very good movie.
It felt like I liked the music in that movie a lot. Yeah. It was Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords did the songs. He won an Oscar for it.
Great stuff.
I told him he would
win an Oscar. I interviewed him and said, you're going to win an Oscar for these songs. And he's like, don't jinx it. I'm like,
they got the spirit of the Muppets, but I felt like they were maybe a little too self-aware about the kind of project they were making. They were a little too careful about the brand of what they wanted the Muppets to be.
I think they did that on purpose, and I think I will give Muppets Most Wanted credit for moving away from that.
Yeah,
and just doing a Muppet movie. I think it's a particularly good Muppet movie. It's pretty funny.
But they did a Muppet movie. It's mid-tier Muppets.
It's mid-tier Muppets. It's definitely not lower-tier Muppets. Like, it's funny. I thought that the Office spinoff show that they did it had a rough start. By about seven episodes in, it got good.
When they changed showrunners, it became good. Like, they actually figured out what it was going to be.
If you, like, if you like gave up on that the Muppets sitcom show they did about 10 years ago because it wasn't very good, go back to it. It's okay if you skip ahead a few episodes, but just sit through like the first like handful, because they're like they're okay, but they're not good. It gets really good in the second half of season one. Like, it's legitimately rock solid Muppets.
Yeah,
and it's a damn shame that they gave up, that they quit on it before it had a chance to really go somewhere.
And the title was just Muppets, if I recall.
Not like, even with like a period at the end, something like that.
Because right, it was a spoof of The Office. Here's a letter from Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. To start my letter, I would like to bring up a few Looney Tunes animated shorts
okay.
that I feel were absent from your lists.
There's many, so please.
If I were to make a list, I would admit I would cheat and make my number 10 all the Roadrunner and Coyote shorts combined.
I actually thought about doing that, but I thought it was too much of a cheat.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't pick just one. Like, which one's got a funnier anvil gag?
They're all pretty terrific. You know, they're all indistinguishable. They are all indistinguishable from the others, but I do adore them.
Yeah.
But the two that I feel were omissions were Baton Bunny and the Rabbit of Seville. I think we talked about the Rabbit of Seville.
Mentioned it briefly, and I think Rabbit of Seville occupies that rarefied What's Opera Doc state where it's kind of like
it's pretty
well regarded, but we probably should have given it at least as much of a mention as we did What's Opera Doc.
There are two reasons I choose to get a degree in musical composition: John Williams film scores and Looney Tunes shorts.
Yeah.
And for the animated shorts that time gags flawlessly with musical cues, there is none finer than Baton Bunny and the Rabbit of Seville. I won't bother reminding you that the Rabbit of Seville, because you briefly mentioned it on your Iron List episode, but if you need a refresher on which one is Baton Bunny, it's the one where Bugs is conducting an orchestra and becomes distracted by a fly that keeps buzzing around him. The orchestra responds to every irritated gesture by Bugs until the unflappable Bugs just loses his shit trying to kill this goddamn motherfucking fly, and the expense of not just the instruments and the orchestra, but the audience who abandons the performance. Now onto the actual reason I decided to write this email. Let me set the scene. You are sitting in the hall of a medical building. There are offices for general practitioners and various medical specialists. A member of the medical team greets you and ushers you both into a large room where there is a large chair that looks something like a dentist's chair that backs into something that looks like an MRI machine that is big enough for a human head. On the wall, you see pictures of satisfied customers.
Okay.
One is a wild-looking man in a Hawaiian t-shirt, looking sad while gazing into a picture of Kate Winslet. And another is a man who looks like the former governor of California, who may or may not be a cybernetic killbot from the future.
What's going on?
A technician approaches and welcomes you with a kind smile. They tell you that, if you choose, they can erase all memory of a film that you have seen for 24 hours, so you can rewatch it as if you have had no previous knowledge and can thus experience it all for the first time.
Oh, God. Okay. This could have gone so much creepier than that. I was really worried for a minute.
While they're removing your intestines with a fish hook. No. They have a theater next door with a quantum projector that will draw out from a negative space wedgie or whatever movie you pick. So you can have the full theatrical experience. Concessions can be picked up from a food replicator on the wall. Okay, so you can recreate it.
You have the perfect experience, yeah.
Before any of you can make an objection about getting your brains accidentally scrambled, the technician turns to you with a reassuring smile and says, "And don't worry, I know what I'm doing. I'm a shipper receiver from Canada who works with musical instruments. Yes, I just dropped myself into the story for no good reason."
Cool.
Okay, we trust you.
Sure.
So what movie do you pick? Do you choose something with a twist? Do you pick a horror movie to relive the jump scares for the first time? Do you pick pure spectacle? And for anyone who may get uppity about potential spoilers, don't worry. There's enough juice in the chair for you to wink. But yeah, please don't worry about spoilers. I would love to hear your honest answers. Hope you guys are doing well and see you on the other side of the scary door. Yoinks and away. Sincerely, nice. Jeremy. And there's also a postscript. Ever since you guys brought up that one romance book at the start of your podcast, it's your Fabio book.
Oh,
I can't get it out of my head. Bibbs, if your partner ever choose to propagate, I wish to submit the name Fabio Bibbiani Lopez da Silva for consideration for baby names.
Nice. I appreciate that you put Michelle's last name properly last, because it would be. moving on. It's funny, I've actually gotten this question, not nearly as elaborate, but I've gotten this question a few times before.
Like, if you could erase a film from your memory and experience it for the first time again.
Because there are certain films that, you know, they change upon watching them. The act of discovering a movie for the first time can be really enrapturing. And we sometimes talk about how, like, you know, sometimes there's this attitude where, like, oh, you never saw 2001 A Space Odyssey? Well, how dare you? But that's not healthy. What's healthier is, congratulations, you get to watch it for the first time. What an exciting experience that's going to be for you. And there's a few times when I wish I could go back and just watch something for the very first time with really fresh eyes. There's three movies that I can't decide between.
Okay.
One is one of the first, like, classic movies I ever saw. I loved it then, and every time I've rewatched it, I've discovered something new about it. But it's been so long, I can't really remember, like, exactly what it was like to go through the whole experience. Mm-hmm. And that's Citizen Kane.
Okay.
It's got so much depth, it's so rich, and there's so much exciting filmmaking in it, that to watch it for the first time would probably just blow my fucking mind. Mm-hmm. Also great filmmaking, but a twist, is Psycho.
Okay.
To watch Psycho for the first time, having no idea what's going on.
That would be... I might choose something like Psycho. Like something with a story reveal that I'm not familiar with yet.
We reached an interesting point with Psycho, because there was, for a while there, everyone knew the ending of Psycho, even if you'd never seen Psycho, because it was kind of famous.
Lampooned everywhere.
Yeah, and then there were sequels, and they kind of they were well advertised, so you kind of just got the gist of it. We reached a point now where there's enough generations removed that some people don't know that. And actually, it is, like, a little more rarefied, and they're actually going to get that full experience, and I envy that. Good for them. And the other one, this isn't a twist. It's a classic movie, but in a different way, I think, than Citizen Kane. It would be cool if you could not just erase the experience of watching the movie, but all of my cultural memories, like, surrounding it.
Mm.
Because some movies are more than movies. You know, like, you can't just, like... to watch Spider-Man for the first time would be one thing. To watch Spider-Man and not know who Spider-Man was would be even more exciting.
Oh, there you go.
So I would be fascinated to watch for the very first time, knowing nothing, not a goddamn thing about it.
Uh-huh.
Don't know anything about the sequels or the spin-offs or the YouTube videos have been about it or the Twitter conversations. What would it be like to watch Star Wars: A New Hope knowing nothing?
Nothing about Star Wars.
Just like, are the stars mad at each other? How does this work? What sort of new hope is available to these planetoids? I'm curious. Hit play. It'd be fascinating.
No. Yeah, you'd have to sort of erase a lot of because I didn't see Star Wars until relatively later in my life. I was 18 when I first saw it, and I didn't grow up rewatching it. I graduated high school, and then I watched Star Wars that summer.
But you didn't go in a vacuum.
But yeah, the thing is, I because it was just sort of around Star Wars was such this pervasive cultural experience, and
you'd seen Muppet Babies episodes about it and stuff like that.
Muppet Babies, Pigs in Space, read along books, references in everything, clips on TV and stuff, friends enacting lines of dialogue. Mm. I knew every detail of Star Wars before I saw the movie.
It's an institution. Yeah, exactly.
I'd seen the movie. By the time I actually watched the movie for the first time, it was almost like a formality. It's like, okay, now I'll just kind of see it to have it be done, even though I know the story and all the twists.
Yeah. It's a great movie, but it's not the same, is it?
That first one is my favorite.
Yeah, but to be able to watch it opening weekend, having only maybe seen the poster.
So would I be erasing just the experience of having watched it, or would I have all that other experiences?
If I can erase the whole experiences, I think I'd go Star Wars. If I can't, I'm only erasing memories of watching the movie, I do Citizen Kane or Psycho. I can't decide which.
The thing about erasing a movie and seeing it for the first time fresh is it's rare than a movie grabs me the first time.
Mm.
Often, my favorite movies are things that I've considered for a little while. I've watched them. It's like, oh, that was really funny. But sometimes the high will wear off, and I'll not really give it another mind. It's like, oh, that was really, really fun. Okay, I'm kind of done thinking about that now. Sometimes I see it, and I'm vaguely impressed, but then it's not until I've sort of thought about it, maybe watched it a second time, that it becomes one of my favorite movies. Yeah. And I build up this sort of affection for it over time. I think if I were to erase my memory and watch it again for the first time, I wouldn't fall in love with it the same way I had over the course of a long period of time.
Well, it's also worth noting that, a lot of the movies that we fall in love with for one reason or another, a lot of them are because of when we saw them.
Yeah, exactly.
When you saw them when in your formative experience. Mm-hmm. Let's say, for example, I erased the memory of watching The Maltese Falcon.
Okay.
Falcon was a great movie. It'd be cool to watch it again for the first time, having no idea the twist at the end with the Falcon and all that kind of stuff. However, I've still seen stuff that was influenced by it. I still have seen other film noirs. I've seen L.A. Confidential. I've seen The Big Sleep. I've seen all these other things. And as a result, Maltese Falcon was one of the first film noirs I ever saw. Mm. I don't think it was the first, but it was right up there. So it's not going to have that, explosive impact of being, your first experience with something. sometimes you watch things that are just come along at the right point in your life. I think it was Gene Siskel's favorite movie was Saturday Night Fever. Mm. I don't even think he thought it was the best movie ever made, but he needed it when he saw it. Mm. And it was really important to him. If he saw that when he was 50, it probably wouldn't have the same impact. But right. It wouldn't be his favorite movie.
Well,
you know,
I'd be interested to, like, if I take a movie that I, like, grew up loving, and I grew up loving it because I saw it many times as a youth.
Yeah.
My tastes have changed.
Yeah.
I erase my memory. I say, okay, I've instructed you to erase my memory of this movie. I'm going to see it for the first time.
Yeah.
I might laugh at my youthful selves, like, this is my favorite movie. This is it?
Really?
This one? Yeah. This one right now. You're telling me that I was obsessed with Brain Donors and I recommended this one a lot? Actually, Brain Donors
was
probably
You probably
laugh,
think Brain Donors was funny, but, you know, maybe not the best example.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of films sort of influenced my sense of humor. So yeah. It's like, would I be refilling the same gap?
But you know what we're doing? We're doing the sci-fi thing where we're, like, overthinking, like, the logistics.
Guess what? We watched Star Trek. That's our métier.
God, you said métier. You finish your drink. You just said métier.
So what? I get to do that.
I don't say you it's don't. I'm word. Saying everyone should finish your drink. I'm not saying you should be boozing it up, but if you have a Pepsi in your hand, go ahead and finish that bad boy. So what would you pick? Yeah, I don't think you've actually picked one.
No, I haven't. I don't think I have an answer.
You don't have... You wouldn't just stop overthinking it. Just be like, what would be cool just to see for the first time because, you know, it was a cool twist. Or maybe it was just a really funny film and the gags aren't old now. Like, watching Airplane for the first time would probably be really funny, right?
Yeah, or Holy Grail. Some of those
comedy
films.
Oh, my God,
films.
That's a great pick, Holy Grail. Like, I guess I've memorized that
Monty Python and the Holy Grail, I think I would want to watch again for the first time.
That's a great pick.
I think that would still make me laugh, regardless.
Yeah, that 98% of that movie still works. Mm. Yeah, great. Great choice. Boom. Sorry. You did it. I'm proud of you. That's it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. We're sorry if we didn't get to your email. Feel free to write in again if it's super important or maybe timely, which sometimes happens. People want to say, like, happy birthday to somebody or something like that. Make sure you, like, either, like, put something in the headline, let us know that it's timely, or you can always give Whitney Seibold a nudge on Twitter. He's at Whitney Seibold.
Yeah, I'll see it.
Okay, I'm at William Bibbiani. Together we're at Critically Acclaimed. We're at Critic Acclaim.
Critic Acclaim.
Critically Acclaimed was too long for Twitter. But if you want to email us, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we have a P.O. box. And Whitney Seibold, what is that?
Yeah, send us an actual physical letter. Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And until the day comes when we get so much, like, snail mail that it becomes unwieldy, if you write us a letter, we will read it.
Yeah, right.
Will,
right now we're
if
receiving,
you go through the effort we
right
will
now
definitely
we're receiving
read your letter.
A few enough physical letters that we read them all when we get them.
Yeah. We can't promise that if everyone takes advantage of that, we'll continue to be able to read every single one. But if you do actually write us a physical letter, we will read it unless it's, like, I don't know, weirdly profane or something like that. Like, I guess we can't make that promise, but that's our goal, basically. Yeah. And of course, I mentioned the Twitter, Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. That's where you can hear our Star Trek podcast, reviewing every single episode of Star Trek ever. We just released a new episode of Only the Best, where we review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We've got commentary tracks. We just scheduled our latest online hangout for the month. Whole bunch of stuff over there. Thank you to all of our patrons for keeping the show going. We couldn't do it without you. We wouldn't want to. And thank you, everybody, who wrote in. And I guess that's that.
That's that.
Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.